You're listening to The Rush on News Talk 1010 Toronto.
Thanks, I'm Norm Macdonald, and now the fake news. Well, it is finally official. Murder is legal in the state of California.
No, I did not commit those murders. I couldn't kill anyone. And I don't know of anyone that was involved. Anything that I might say along those lines would be pure speculation.
You're scared?
Just tell them I'm all sorry. You can tell them later on today in the morning I was sorry. And I'm sorry that I did this to the police.
That, of course, is a montage thanks to our friend Mike Catherwood of O.J. Simpson, passed away yesterday. It was announced by his family earlier today at the age of 76. So we're going to get their takes, our smart speakers today, what they think, what they're remembering about O.J. Simpson and all things associated with O.J. Those smart speakers are Scott Reed, CTV political commentator and advisor to a number of prime ministers, premiers, and political leaders, and Laura Babcock, Power Group Communications and host of The O Show. Welcome back to The Rush, you guys. Start with you, Laura, your thoughts on this day when we found out that O.J. Simpson has passed away.
It made me remember when I was a journalism student and asked if the teacher could bring in a camera so we could or a TV so we could watch it in the studio during class to see what that verdict was. Because as you recall, the world was riveted, or at least North America was. And, you know, the verdict was, of course, a shock to many. And I just remember thinking at the time, wow, it really comes down to who you can pay for as a lawyer, because that dream team of lawyers and Johnny Cochran with the glove, it was such a performance. And it just didn't seem like the prosecutors could ever match their legal skills. And then, of course, afterwards, it was the behavior around OJ, the comments he would make, the kind of casual weighing in on the situation. It never felt, and this is my perspective, but it never felt like justice was done. It felt like if you had money and you could hire a dream team, then you could get away with murder.
Scott Reed.
Well, I definitely thought he got away with murder. I no doubt in my mind that he did it. I had, you know, very little involvement. I wasn't there, but I watched it like everybody else religiously at the time. We were throwing a big party for my pal. You, I think both, maybe all three of you know my friend David Hurley. It was his birthday party. We're in a restaurant, and all of a sudden, people had to pile in the bar to see the little tiny TV over the bar because of the white Bronco chase. It was like, I remember it clear as a bell. It was a mind-blowing moment. But here's a hot take for you. Obviously, a despicable figure and got away with murder. Lots of other, terrible sins on his ledger. But I think you can make an argument that he's one of the most influential, high-profile pop culture figures. I would say top 10, top 5, maybe even, of the second half of the 20th century. Because if you combine his celebrity and profile as a football player, both at college and then, of course, in the pros, then as an actor, and then the startling pop culture monoculture moment where everyone in the world gathered around to watch his trial and the aftermath. It's hard to name 9 people that were more influential and, frankly, more dividing in terms of how the public interpreted those events. So
I was thinking you were going to say that, Scott. I mean, because there's a difference between being influential and being divisive. I mean, I agree he was divisive and he was notorious, but was he really influential? In what way was he influential?
Well, I mean, impactful, I guess.
Impactful. That's a good word. That's a better word. You're right.
I think, I think one of the truly dramatic pop culture figures, like for decades, he dominated headlines, and it was, he was never off people's lips. And I just think, you know, he influenced a lot of events. I think he influenced a lot of opinion and perspective. And it's a horrifying legacy, but it's also pretty astonishing in its scope.
It is that. And I think there's more to come. Sorry, go ahead, Laura.
I was just going to say, if I had to look for something influential out of it, I think the trial influenced jurisprudence. I think it influenced show trials. The concept of what we're coming into, the first time in U.S. history that a past president is going to court for a criminal charge. This is coming up next week. And I think that it's going to have echoes of the OJ trial, just that sense of how far are they going to go? How much is the media coverage of the trial going to have an impact? So we're kind of walking into, I think, something that might rival the scope of what we saw when we all watched the OJ trial back in those years. So I think there's definitely an influence in his legacy from assembling that dream team and everything that that did to change how we perceive law and court trials.
It's such an interesting way to bring it up to the present, because, you know, the test is the same in court on a criminal charge, which is beyond a reasonable doubt. And so what Trump has to do is the same as what all those talented lawyers had to do, which is to create a reasonable doubt in the minds of a jury, which they did. Scott?
Well, they'll be looking for the, if it doesn't fit, acquit, right?
That's right.
If they can come up with something like that.
Yes. Scott?
Yeah.
I was just going to say, we all now know, beyond a shadow of a doubt, the leather shrinks. And that was something that maybe wasn't established in the public mind prior to the trial.
We were talking about that earlier. Anybody who's ever taken off a pair of kids' gloves and put them on the radiator for like a half an hour know that. But I guess those lawyers figured that that no one else would figure that out. So one of the other things we were talking about today, Deb and me, was a bill that's been brought in by the Premier of Alberta to say quite literally that if Ottawa, the federal government, tries to fund cities, which, as you know, are self-described and described in the Constitution as sort of creatures of or creations of the provincial governments, that she will declare those deals to be illegal, in effect, and kind of set them to one side. And is this show business? You don't want to talk about trials that are show trials. Is this a kind of a show bill that is meant to really just highlight the difference between that province and others and the federal government? Or is it something that is a legitimate exercise of her responsibility under the Constitution? Maybe start with you, Scott.
Well, I think it fits within the continuum, particularly for Danielle Smith and her party in Alberta, of, you know, this sort of pretend constitutional rigidity where, oh, well, this is provincial jurisdiction and therefore we are virtually a sovereign country. It's actually not how the Constitution works, and it's not how practical terms work. You know, I worked, as you know, John, I worked for a prime minister who, went to the wall on the idea that actually the federal government ought to have a relationship with cities, and we ought to find direct transfers to cities, and we ought to have a direct relationship there, because cities are where 80% of Canadians live, and they require support and resources. And, you know, I kind of think it's all just political theater on the part of Danielle Smith. I think most of what she does is performative and, frankly, thin and stupid. And,
aside from that, how do you feel about it?
But I think she's a farce, to be honest with you. I really do.
It's show business. It is. It is. She's talking about show business. It is. Laura, do you agree with that or have a different take?
Well, I mean, her background, of course, is show business, is doing this
talk
kind
shows
of stuff.
And
Death. Yeah, exactly. But you know what? She hasn't brought any gravitas. She hasn't grown with the office. She keeps doing these kind of performative Wexit nonsense, challenging the federal government to look all tough and anti-Trudeau stuff. But here's where I come down on this as an actual policy she's trying to put forward. I mean, there's a reason why in Ontario, historically, people don't want the same party to be in federal leadership and provincial leadership in this province, because we like that tension. And so not only does that tension allow us to avoid 100% ideological crackdowns, right, where you have this balance potentially between ideologies, and this is very much an ideological thing that she's trying to put forward, and she even says that, but it's also, as someone who has been involved in many, many projects municipally, where we had to both court provincial and federal funding to get all the partners around the table, there is something beneficial to our democracy to have to engage in that process, I remember there was a time when there was a Team Hamilton, when there was enough elected officials lined up that could kind of work together. That's long since gone. But just this sense of, you need to get the partners to the table. So what does that look like in terms of negotiations? So this idea that everything has to go through a gatekeeper of a premier is nonsense. It's not only anti-democratic, undemocratic, in my view. It's not pragmatic. This risk put millions, potentially billions, according to the mayors of Edmonton and Calgary, away from getting housing built in during a massive housing crisis. So this is just foolish nonsense, the kind of stuff we'd expect to see from the U.S. Congress. This is not the kind of tone of our politics that we want to accept in Canada, because it's not practical, and I don't think it's how democracy should work.
Yeah, well, I kind of found it slightly appealing. But on that note...
That's why we have these smart speakers and round tables.
Exactly. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll go to something far less controversial, homeless encampments. Welcome back. Thanks so much for joining us this afternoon. It is your guest host, Deb Hutton, and your guest host, John Torrey. And along with us, because, you know, we don't know how to talk enough, you and I, John, we thought we'd join two other folks with us. Scott Reed, CTV political commentator and advisor to a number of prime ministers, premiers, and political leaders, and Laura Babcock, Power Group Communications and host of The O Show. Earlier this afternoon, John and I talked about a Toronto Star article that says that homelessness year over year, 23 to 24, has exploded in the city of Toronto. Numbers have more than doubled. We are getting closer to the numbers that existed during the pandemic, when we all know there were some particularly difficult situations for people that caused a great number to find themselves homeless. John and I took to the calls, took to the board and asked folks for sort of their solutions. One of the things that we started with was the notion that our leadership in the city really needs to say encampments should be illegal. Scott Reed, your reaction to that?
Well, of course they should be illegal. They are a fundamentally unsafe place to be, and they put, you know, they create conditions that are intolerable. And I say it they like it's the fault of the people that are retreating there. But you end up in an unsafe place. It seems ghoulish to try to chase folks out of that situation. But then you end up with fires or crime or harm or physical violence against one another. And obviously, it's no way for anyone to live. The challenge is in part options. The other challenge, of course, is that not everybody is in a position to evaluate their options or wishes to evaluate their options, because a lot of these folks are mentally ill. Why is it increasing? It's increasing because we're living in a difficult time. And so, you know, hopefully 2, 3, 4 years, but it will take 2, 3, 4 years for some of those macro conditions to correct. Hopefully that will ease it. But I fundamentally think we have to reevaluate our approach to homelessness. And I don't think that our current shelter system doesn't answer the challenge before us, because that's not how lots of people who are vulnerable want to live. And so we have to figure out how we meet the problem at its core.
Laura Scott says, well, of course it's illegal, but you know, one of my criticisms is I don't sense that that is the overarching view of our leadership now in the city of Toronto.
I think we have to shift the conversation. Encampments are a result of an affordability crisis that is rocking Canadians to the core. 44% of Canadians are concerned that they're going to be able to stay in their homes or apartments. In Hamilton, in the last 5 years, rent evictions since the rental controls were removed provincially have gone up almost 1,000%. I spend every week, Saturdays when I can, almost every week, down at a food line where there are 1,000 people and I get to talk to them. It used to be 300 6 months ago. Now it's 1,000 every Saturday. And some of them have jobs, but they cannot afford food and their apartment. Some of them were recently rent evicted and they're homeless for the first time. And rather than being on a street corner where they're afraid of being victimized, they want to be in a little encampment community where they think they have at least some kind of support. And so it is not about where you put these encampments. It's about getting people into supportive transitional housing. So we have to stop looking at it like people who don't want to, you know, find other choices or have, drug use issues or mental health issues. It's broader than that. I'm meeting seniors. I'm meeting young families. I'm meeting people who, there are nurses in Hamilton who are living in encampments. And if you look at the cost of an average room to rent in Toronto, it is the same amount as you can get maximizing your ODSP payment. So if you're someone who's injured and you're relying on ODSP to live, you can't afford food and get a room in Toronto. So I think we just need to stop saying, where do we put these encampments? governments and say, how fast can we get housing built? And like Scott said, it's not emergency shelters aren't a solution. They are literally an emergency response. We need to get people into supportive housing ASAP. And the federal government took too long. But let me just say this. The federal government has taken too long to have a national housing strategy with teeth. They're finally doing this wartime effort. Good. But they took too long. Provincially, there have been policies like rent evictions and the rate of ODSB that are leading people to choose between food and being able to be sheltered. So I just want us to look at those macro factors, deal with them on all levels of government, including municipally, and stop being about where to put these people until we give them housing. Housing first is the strategy that has worked for other countries. It's time that we get on it. We know it works.
But if we agreed with all that, which I think most people would, and say there's a solution that needs to be found that is not a tent, in a park, you would still have to come back to the fact that encampments in public parks are illegal and wrong and not safe, as Scott said.
Well, also, though, you have to, and we've seen this, right? Correct me if I'm wrong, guys, but if you don't have shelter beds available, are you able to move people out of these encampments, or is that then a violation? So here's the point, is that pushing people around and hoping they'll go to ravines instead of City Hall forecourts, like the 30-day encampment protest in front of Hamilton City Hall that grew to 82 people within weeks because they had nowhere else to go, and they were at least getting some kind of medical support on site and some sort of attention. I mean, this is where we're at. There are some communities that have figured out, bring the supports to these places where people are already gathered, help them transition. But if we don't have the housing stock, and I've done like 15 O-shows just on this, guys, if we don't have the supportive housing stock, and then the deeply affordable, then the affordable, and then the first-time family, all of it, if we don't have that continuum robustly built up and quickly, we are not going to have anywhere to put all of these individuals that are now whether they're homeless or they're couch surfing or they're the hidden homeless or they are the people that we see in most acute need on the street corners who are injecting, wherever they are on the spectrum, the solution is housing. So I just want us to put our energy and our anger into our governments and how slow they are with housing starts, where the bureaucracy is, where the red tape is. Until we get people into supportive and affordable and housing, we're going to keep arguing about this for the next 5 years.
Well, hang on. Then we're going to argue about it for the next 5 years. Because I'm telling you right now, housing is the solution, is a sentence. It's not a practical, implementable goal within the next 5 years. We're not going to see. I mean, the provincial government right now has a policy that we're going to build 1.5 million homes in the next by 2031. I will bet you the moon that that cannot be accomplished. And there's no way that we are going to tackle the problem that we're talking about if you don't exceed that goal. So I just don't, like, people talk about macro conditions and how, like, well, we need a comprehensive, massive, like, it isn't going to happen. It is not going to happen. And if it happens, it would take a monstrous shift in political priorities, resources, and political will. And that ain't going to happen. But it certainly wouldn't happen for years anyway.
Is that back to the previous topic. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you know, if when Laura says we require a national strategy, well, that is an area where other provinces, I think even including this one here, but certainly Alberta and others have said, stay out of our lane, housing's provincial. So how are you ever going to have a solution if you have that going on where some people are saying there should be a national strategy and a lot of money, other people are saying, including premiers, stay out of this area, this is ours?
I think it's a journey. Focus on a problem and a neighborhood. Say, what can we do within these four city blocks? What can we do in Moss Park? There's been tremendous progress there in terms of what's happened in the last 15 years. But take a neighborhood, take a block and say, all right, what can we pluck from federal resources? What can we pluck from provincial resources? How do we marshal ourselves? Fix a block and then move forward. I think the problem is so large, so overwhelming, and the durations are so huge that you can't come at it that way. You got to come at it street by street, block by block, and then create some forward momentum and progress.
Guys, I'm going to have to cut it there. Laura Babcock, Power Group Communications, Scott Reed, CTV political commentator. Thanks for joining Deb Hutton and John Tory on The Rush.
Thanks to you both.